Succession number 28361, reel 41.
General Julian Thompson, reel 41.
General Julian.
The last thing you said was that you were coming under political pressure to get on with it and do things fast when you were loading the commando brigade to go to the South Atlantic. How was that political pressure applied? Did it come down the chain of command in the normal way, or was it overleaping?
No, the pressure was down the chain of command, and it wasn't in any way overt, in other words, hurry up and get on with it, but it was just the feeling that we were to get on with it as fast as possible, and that we were to start loading after the weekend, people having loaded stores and so forth during the weekend. So I mean, I wasn't rung up by the Prime Minister or any minister or indeed any particular any senior officer, but I can describe later a visit I made to the headquarters at Northwood and the atmosphere there, when we come to it, if you like.
Another thing you said was that Northwood didn't seem to be aware of your need for a particular level of capacity for carrying an enlarged brigade over a greater distance. That seems rather strange, that they shouldn't have understood the requirements of the sort of operation you were being ordered to conduct.
The reinforcement of North Norway plan had always rarely been a brigade minus, and I suppose stuck in their minds, and of course they were under a huge amount of pressure, they got into a sort of tunnel vision thing of this is what it was going to be, i.e. two brigade minus. And so when the brigade started by being the full brigade and then a brigade plus as we acquired more units, they were not able to do the mental arithmetic which persuaded them that we actually did need more shipping. In the end, of course, they came round to it. It just took a little while, and we had a few sort of shouting matches down the telephone, but eventually they actually did react, and they started pulling shipping out, like, for example, supplying the liner Canberra, which was capable of carrying three battalions plus. And when I heard we were going to get the Canberra, it was like Christmas and Easter all rolled into one. At last, they were beginning to see sense. And the reason, of course, that they were not all that clued up was because they had only one chap responsible for amphibious operations on the staff, who was a major, and he actually spent most of his time on security work. And this is a reflection of the fact that the headquarters at Northwood was actually staffed to fight a anti-submarine battle in the Eastern Atlantic against the Soviet Navy. And amphibious operations were so far down their list of priorities that they weren't even on the list.
So you think there was an institutional prejudice against amphibious or expeditionary operations?
There was an institutional prejudice at all levels in the Navy against amphibious operations, and most of them would like to have seen the Royal Marines disbanded and all the amphibious ships got rid of. They regarded them as an excrescence and a burden on the budget, which they would be very glad to get rid of. But this was just the thinking of the time.
Was there anyone at higher levels who was a champion of the Royal Marines and their amphibious role?
There's no one that I can think of who was. Not anyone that I knew about or had ever met, no.
I mean, in the face of this indifference or hostility, how did the Marines manage to survive? Was it by political lobbying, as the Royal Air Force had done in its early...
The Marines managed to survive by the skin of their teeth and by a bit of guile, I think, actually. And really, the key to it was the invention of the northern flank role, and by tying in various people, like, for example, the Dutch Marines, and tying in the Norwegians, who saw themselves as fighting a war stuck out on their own away on a remote flank, and welcomed anyone who would come and fight with them. And so by having partners, as it were, who could raise objections if they saw their putative reinforcements disappearing, that's how it was fought. Unfortunately, it didn't look as if it, that was going to succeed, and had the Knot defence review run through to its logical conclusion, I think that the Royal Marines and the amphibious capability would have eventually, after without the Falklands War, would have just drained off into the sand and would have disappeared without trace, actually.
In 1956, there was a similar intent, I think, based upon the idea that Sirius had proved that amphibious operations were not really very practical. Hmm. And the way in which that attitude was countered was by bringing in evidence from the US Marine Corps, who were developing new amphibious equipment, in particular landing craft, and using helicopters to prove that amphibious assault was still a practicable operation that was useful.
Yes, the Suez, what Suez, it didn't prove that amphibious operations were impractical at all. It played into the hands of those who wanted to do a bit of creative accounting and prove that they weren't, because the equipment being used was sort of old and it didn't look feasible. Beside the blandishments of the Air Force lobby, who produced glossy ideas based on airlift and islands which they moved around the globe to geographically suit them. And you're quite right. So what happened was, in the late 50s, led by Jim Moulton, was this push towards helicopters and LPH. And so you've got to remember, though, that the Royal Marines were the first people to carry out a helicopter assault against an opposed enemy in amphibious operations at Suez, in fact. And so we'd been in the lead on that. And the thing was to capitalise on that experience. And it's that fitted in with defence policy in the late 50s, 60s, and through into the early 70s, which was intervention in post-colonial or the rundown of colonial conflict.
You had the southern flank as well, hadn't you? Those exercises with the Americans around Greece and so on.
Yes.
Described.
Yes, because when we came back from the Far East, the southern flank, for a while, was more manpower intensive, if you like, as far as the Royal Marines were concerned, than the northern flank. The northern flank required you to be trained to live, fight, and move in Norway. And at that stage, only one commando group was trained to do that. The rest of the brigade, which in those days used to consist of four commandos, was concentrated on the southern flank because the guys were not trained to operate in the northern flank in winter. And then eventually the southern flank faded out of the picture, and as far as the Brits were concerned, and we concentrated and put all our eggs in the basket of the northern flank, and that was the situation at the time of the Falklands War.
In 82, you were busy getting your men reassembled from leave or overseas posting, getting your staffs together, getting your staff drawing up loading tables, presumably, and getting ships in. What sort of working day were you putting in at that stage?
Well, to begin with, of course, my staff were all in Denmark on a recce. So I and what the chap who'd been my DQ, or DCOS, as they call it now, plus my G3 INT, or SO3 INT, and my SO3 training, worked on the plans ourselves. So you had this rather pathetic picture of a brigade commander without a staff. And unlike the way a brigade commander normally operates, which is rather like a DS at the staff college, where he says to his staff, I want the answers to these, and I'll be back in 40 minutes, and I want them by then. He then walks out of the room. I was actually the chap having to write. I was the chap who'd be given the essay by the tutor, if you like, and having to actually write the essay. So it was. I found that very. Not a strain, but I found it difficult because at the same time I was being asked to think of the more forward-thinking questions, like, would I like this? Do I want that? How many of this should we take? Which is what the commander should be thinking about, not scribbling around number crunching and trying to fit men into ships. But because the only chaps left were pretty junior, and in any case my DQ, ex-DQ, was starting to get involved in the logistic problems, until about tea time, I was actually sort of like a duck, peddling furiously through the water, trying to personally answer all these questions. My staff eventually appeared, led by my inestimable brigade major, chief of staff, and they'd sort of bullied people to get them on the first flights back from Denmark. They came through the door all grinning all over their faces. And I then quickly told them what the problem was, and down to work they got. It immediately started getting better from then on. Now, the sort of day, I can't remember what sort of hours they worked, probably every hour that God gave them. But I usually packed up at about 6 or 7 and then went home.
How were you actually doing the business? Was it all done on paper by signal and written memorandum and orders, or was it being done verbally?
It was done face to face verbally, but the number crunching, of course, was done on paper. I mean, I didn't send people bits of paper. And what I did, as I think I said before, I realised that the mounting headquarters, which was Command of Forces, it was worth being alongside them. So, in fact, if you like, I set up my TAC alongside my superior headquarters. So I was able to just walk across into another room to the Chief of Staff Command of Forces and say, I want this, 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 and this, you know, and walk out of the room. And so there's no question of picking up a phone or sending in bits of paper. That was within the two headquarters. It worked like that. Of course, outside the two headquarters, it was either on a secure phone or by signal.
Something that arises when you're doing this sort of planning and liaising with headquarters and units that are remote from your location is the question of security. Were you at that time conscious that it's possible there might be an espionage or security threat to what you were doing?
I was only aware of it on the basis that I was always aware that that was a problem. And therefore, whoever you were dealing with, and after all, the planning we'd been doing for NATO and and that sort of thing was up against a highly sophisticated Soviet security threat. And therefore, if you were accustomed to working in that sort of environment, anything the Argentines might provide was not actually going to be a great challenge. And so there were secure scrambler phones. That was the other advantage of moving up alongside my superior headquarters. I didn't have any in my own headquarters, but there were secure scrambler phones in the headquarters linking what was then Sink Fleet's headquarters and MOD and Command of Forces, and I could use those. And of course, signals were perfectly secure if they were properly routed and properly classified. And there was no computer, that was the great point. There were no emails, no computer screens. I come on to computers later. I'm going to talk about how my Remy chap fiddled with the computer on board the ship to make it into a word processor. But the production of BUMF was a very laborious progress. I mean, you still had Gestetners, which you turned by hand or pressed a button if you were lucky.
Typewriting a stencil and then putting it on the
duplicator. Exactly. There was no... there were photocopiers, yes, but that was a very expensive way of producing BUMF. And so all the number crunching had to be done literally by hand.
So what was number crunching about? Was it about fitting men and pieces of equipment into carriers to get them down to...
Into ships of all kinds, and sometimes into ships which you'd never seen before, and therefore merchant ships, and therefore you didn't know what their capacity was. There was a book called the Red Book, which had all the British flag merchant ships listed in it, which gave their dimensions, but only in very round terms, and it was usually done in what was known as, as far as I can remember, half-ton equivalents, which in other words was... It would take 50 half-ton equivalents. Now, a half-ton equivalent was a Land Rover. And a four-ton truck was, I can't remember, 2.5 half-ton equivalents. And what you're worried about when you're loading a ship is not only the floor area that the vehicle takes up, but, of course, its height. Can you get it into that space? How do you get it in there in the first place? And so took quite a lot of number crunching. Because as the brigade got bigger, for example, the air defense battery, which we'd never had before, arrived with X sorts of vehicles and Y types of kit. It was not an amphibious battery. Therefore, none of the dimensions were in half-ton equivalents. So you didn't know how many rapier firing posts you could get into a given space. So there was a huge amount of number crunching. And every time you put something in, you had to take something out if you were bulking out. Nowadays, all you do is you punch in X, whatever it is, and they say, right, you can put it in. And then if you put another Y thing in there, automatically your computer will throw out something to make room for it.
Let you know it's thrown it out.
Oh, it lets you know it's thrown it out, yeah.
Sounds really rather more like geometry than arithmetic.
It is. I mean, to load ships, some staffs use little templates. And you had a plan of the ship and you just fitted them in physically. You said, I can put that in, that in, that in, that in, that in, and so on. So it was a very manpower intensive performance.
And getting the ships, was it a question of you putting up a requirement through the higher headquarters saying, we need so much capacity or so many ships? Or was it a case of the people taking the ships up from trade saying to you, you've got this, this and this, do what you can with it?
It was a two-way street. We said we wanted capacity of that. And then they would look up and say, well, we'd really like to give you the whatever it is,
the Atlantic Conveyor,
but that's probably a bad example because she was available, but some other ship. Mm. But unfortunately, she's in the Bahamas or she's in Hawaii. So you know won't get there in time, and so that was one of the problems, that you were given what was around, and within a few days, literally 2 or 3 days steaming of Britain. I mean, for example, the Canberra was on the last leg of her world cruise, and she suddenly, to the passengers' astonishment, she was seen to be slowing down as she approached Gibraltar, and they were told, oh, why are we going to Gibraltar? And, you know, we've done that on the way out. We don't want to go there again. And so the captain of the ship said, oh, well, this is a special customs and excise team who are coming to visit us for the last leg. And a boat came out, a whole load of chaps in jungle greens and short hair swarmed up the side and came on board. And it was the advance party coming to do the recce of the ship, so that when she arrived in Southampton, work could start immediately. So the passage between Gibraltar and UK, which was a day and a half or something, or 2 days, was used up by these guys rushing around doing their recce while the passengers were still on board. So that was the sort of thing that happened.
When you were doing this work, what were the problems or the issues that were at the top of your mind in order of priority and importance?
Well, the first priority was, what are we going to do when we get there?
I mean, your objective.
Objective.
Okay.
Because to carry out an amphibious operation by the book, can I just stop before you go on? Because we were talking about.
I was asking you. You were saying that the most important thing that you wanted to know was what were you going to do when you got there. In other words, what's your objective?
Exactly. Exactly. Now, if everything is going by the book or as it should do. The way you do an amphibious operation in round terms, you discover what you want to do, and then you discover as much as you can about the opposition and the terrain and so on, i.e. intelligence, and then you start your loading, because you want to make certain you're combat loaded to fit the situation that you're going to have to face.
Because you weren't able to do that anyway, were you?
No.
You were loading at random.
We were loading at random with ships as they appeared, and secondly, they hadn't told us what the mission was. I mean, you might say, well, you should know, it's to go and retake the Falkland Islands, but not necessarily. It might have been to hang around for months and months and months at sea while they made their minds up what they wanted to do, and while you were raiding or doing something else, in which case you want to be loaded differently. And you also would like to have a thing called an initiating directive, which comes down from on high, which says that you have this force and you're to do this and you're to do it by, etc., and setting out any parameters. That, we never had one of those either.
That would be a sort of framework.
It's a framework which comes down from above.
But isn't that normally a wish list rather than a...
No, it could be. It is a directive, and the initiating directive. It comes down and it says you've got these number of ships and this is your force and this is your mission and you're to achieve it by X. And any parameters, which could be you're not to invade that country and you're not to cross that thing and you're not to shoot down airplanes, whatever it is. But we never had one of those either. So though at the front of my mind all the time was, what are we meant to be doing, was the first priority. The second priority was to make certain, within the very severe constraints, that we were combat loaded. And it turned out that we weren't, and therefore we had to do a reshuffle, which I can come on to. And then one of the priorities, which I was able to fulfil 2 days later, on the 4th of April, was to get everybody together, all the COs, so I could tell them what the hell was going on, face to face. including getting what were my sort of newcomers, i.e. people who weren't in my brigade, together.
Who would they be? Your air defence man, presumably?
Well, the people who weren't normally part of my brigade was my air defence battery, Hugh Pike commanding 3 para at this stage. Others came later. The 2 troops of Blues and Royals, an extra gunner battery, but because he was looked after by the CO. So there were about 5 newcomers, but I also wanted to get hold of my normal team and tell them what was going on. Now, what I did was I summoned them to an O group on the 4th of April. This is now 2 days after we start. And at the same time, I told them they were to bring their adjutants or their ops officers with them. And we had 2 sessions. I had a commander session with the commanders, while my DCOS, with all the sort of movers and cooks and bottle washers and guys, had another session in a totally different room, doing ship loading plans, telling them, particularly leading some of the new boys by the hand, saying, we need from you the following information. Well, in fact, they were told to come with it in their hands, and telling them how to load, what the parameters were, and to start giving them timings for loading.
So, on the one hand, you had an ops
session. I had an ops session.
And then there was a log and admin.
There was a log and admin session.
And that was going on simultaneously.
Exactly,
in parallel.
To save time.
Hmm. So, when you got your chaps together, including the new boys, what did you tell them, and what did you think it was particularly important to tell the new boys?
Okay. I can tell you what I told them. We started with a situation report from what we knew about the situation, which wasn't much. We then did a quick terrain brief as part of the preamble on South Georgia by a chap who'd just come back from an expedition to South Georgia, because we thought we might have to go there first. And then we had a very quick terrain brief on the Falklands, just so that people could go away, CEOs could go away and think about kit and equipment and that sort of thing. Then
Things like clothing,
what the weather was like and all that sort of thing. I mean, it was just a quick burst.
Yeah.
We came on and did much more of that later. Then I stood up and said something that I would often say. I said, this is not an orders group. You're not going to get orders here. So they didn't think that, you know, I was going to give them a battle plan. I said, what I'm going to give you is just a few points to march on so that you can go away and get cracking. I said, the first thing I want to make absolutely clear to you all is that this is going to take a very long time, and there's going to be a considerable amount of buggering about going on at a very high level, which means that we're going to be buggered about and kept in the dark, and this may go on for weeks. So you ought to tell your people that this is what they're to expect. The second thing I said was, and I addressed this particularly to people who'd never been in ships before, I said, there is a tendency when you're at sea to think that doing any sort of training is so difficult that it's impossible and you'll just lie on your scratches all day and get unfit. I said, there's a lot of training you can do, I can tell you, from great experience, and you are to do it. One, you're to keep fit, and you're to do daily exercise lasting no less than 1 hour a day in boots and carrying loads. Second, you are to think through the sort of training you can do. And I said, let me just give you some tips. You can do first aid training. You can get your gunners to teach every single man down to private how to direct artillery and mortar fire. You can do radio procedure training. You can do recognition training of enemy weapons and equipment. And I said, you know, you can do very basic shooting. You can do CP exercises, but God's sake, don't transmit. You can do a whole stack of things if you really use your imagination and don't allow the conditions to you know, put you into the it's all too difficult syndrome. And you are to do this training, and they did.
How did the new boys react to this rather informal way of going on? Because most formations, presumably they'd be used to the orders group procedure of mission enemy friendly.
Well, it didn't lend itself to a mission enemy friendly, because I didn't know anything about the enemy. We hadn't been given a mission. My staff were used to it, and my boys were used to it, because I divided my things, my sessions with them, into O groups, where I followed the procedure completely, and that's what they got when they got orders, and they recognised it. that when I just wanted to tell them something, I didn't try and straitjacket it into the orders procedure, because I wasn't giving orders. I was merely telling them what I wanted them to do.
I think they
didn't find it odd at all, actually.
When you were doing this, what sort of questions were they asking you, like Hugh Pike and their defence?
I remember asking if there were any questions, and there weren't any, which meant to me that they were not in any doubt about what I wanted them to do.
A stunned silence.
Probably. I mean, I knew Hugh anyway from from Salford, and he'd been an enemy on Exercise a year before for me. And so, no, I think what I wanted to impress upon them was that I was going to give them a lead on what I wanted them to do, and I also wanted them to come away with the thought that the headquarters they were going to work with was pretty efficient and knew what it was doing. And I think both those, I hope, came across.
Now, you were saying that you didn't know much about the enemy.
Yeah.
What were your sources of information about
the enemy? Right. Well, my G3 INT, as we called him, SO3 INT, immediately. That was a highly intelligent, very battle-experienced chap who'd commanded a company in the Dauphin, where he'd been decorated. He rushed off to the Plymouth Public Library and got out the Jane's series, where so he looked up their air force, their navy, and their army. He also got out I can't remember what it's called now, the strategic balance produced by
the
ISS. Says he got that out. And that was actually our source of information to begin with, because we didn't know what units had been involved in the reinforcement. We learnt later what units had been involved in the invasion, but of course by the time we got there, those chaps had gone. It was a totally different bunch of formations. So the intelligence on what was there was pretty thin.
Did you have any Spanish speakers or readers on the staff?
Yes, I had a... in my headquarters and signal squadron, I had a chap called Rod Bell, who had been brought up in Costa Rica, and he was a young officer under my command when I was when I was the training officer at the officer's training wing, Limston. And when he arrived, he spoke better Spanish than he did English. He spoke absolutely fluent South American Spanish, and he was a very, very key person throughout the campaign, actually.
Because the Argentinians weren't really very security conscious, were they? They were broadcasting and publishing what they were doing, rather...
Yes, they were, and there was another source of information which I can come on to later, which gave us a huge amount of information. But there was a... We had immediately available on my staff, I had Rod Bell, who was the 2IC of the Headquarters and Signal Squadron, was a captain. I had a Marine... who was a driver, wasn't born for Spanish interpreting duty, he was born to drive a truck, but he was a Gibraltarian and spoke Spanish fluently.
Well, his would be Castilian.
His would be Castilian Spanish, but at least he spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I think those were the only two. Oh yes, and the headquarters, my OC headquarters and signal squadron was a Spanish interpreter. So I had three immediately available, which was quite good, actually. Not bad.
What about the Joint Intelligence Committee and the official sources of it? Were they managing to feed anything down into your...
Well, not that I was aware of, no. Not that I was aware of, no. I mean, they may have been feeding it down, but if it was, it never got to me.
Foreign Office presumably should have had information coming in too.
Yes, I should imagine so, but I don't remember there being any particularly good... source of information. In fact, I about the only decent source of information on what the troops were like were BBC takes of Argentine television, showing them all arriving and invading the Falkland Islands.
What impression did you get from those bits of footage?
I think my main one was why they were all wearing goggles in a place. Well, did they think they were fighting in the desert? Of course, the one source, not of the enemy, but of the islands, was Ewan South Petelia, who was a major who had been in the Falkland Islands naval party about 3 years before and had spent his time going round in a craft, a vessel, looking at likely beaches that the enemy might use, actually what he was doing was preparing a yachting pilot, which he hoped he would sell when he got back. No one was interested. And he appeared in my headquarters that first morning. Under his arm was a huge roll of charts, and in his hand was a great stack of notebooks. And he had a